how dedicated you are. Just be sure you have those contingencies in place should you later want to back out. I've even known some investors who offer all cash, no contingencies, and they make their earnest money deposit the exact same amount as the purchase price. In other words, they're guaranteeing a sale on the offer. Now that is a powerful offer, but risky. Number 12, provide your pre-approval letter with the offer. If you'll be using bank financing for the purchase, be proactive and include a copy of your pre-approval letter with your offer. It's one thing to tell the seller that you can qualify, but it's another for them to physically hold the pre-approval letter in their hands so they know that the sale will go through. Number 13, include an escalation clause. An escalation clause can be included in an offer and is used when a property might have multiple bidders. It essentially says, if someone else bids higher than me, this offer will automatically increase to X amount above theirs up to a certain point. So you might offer $100,000 on a property, but include an escalation clause that says that you will pay $500 more than any other offer that comes in up to $110,000. This way, if someone comes in and offers $106,000, your bid will automatically increase up to $106,500. The danger of an escalation clause, of course, is that it tells the seller exactly how high you'll go. Therefore, only use an escalation clause if you know that there's going to be multiple offers and never make your maximum price higher than what you should really pay. Number 14, offer to clean out the property. Houses can accumulate a lot of stuff over time, and removing the stuff can be incredibly overwhelming to the seller. Therefore, if you are offering on a property that has a lot of junk in it, make your offer stand out by offering to clean out the property for the seller. Or, to tie in one of the tips I mentioned earlier, give the seller two offers, one that includes junk removal and one that doesn't. Number 15, pay the seller's closing costs. Selling a home can be expensive, so if the math works for you, consider offering to pay part or all of the seller's closing costs. Number 16, offer again. Finally, remember this. Just because your offer was turned down, that doesn't mean you can't offer again soon. I once offered $60,000 on a property that was listed at $80,000 and was rejected. Yeah, I let it go. After the property sat in the market for three more months, the seller dropped their price down to $59,000, lower than my original offer. So I offered him $40,000 at that point, and finally my offer was accepted, $20,000 less than I had originally offered to pay. Wrapping it up. Making an offer is scary. It's overwhelming, and it's a big deal. However, it is also necessary if you want to get off the sidelines and take your future by the tail so it submits to your desires. As with a marriage proposal, if you want to hear yes, you need to first present the offer. There are no two ways about it. The dating phase is over. It is time to get serious. Of course, certain discussions need to take place before the transaction can actually happen. Who's going to pay for what? When is it going to happen? How do we know this is really the right thing? In real estate, this is known as the negotiation period, and your success at this stage will determine your success of your financial future. So let's talk about negotiation next. Chapter 12, Real Estate Negotiation. Chester L. Carras once said, "In business as in life, you don't get what you deserve, you get what you negotiate." It started with a flock of Canadian geese in the wrong place at the wrong time. On an average, cold January afternoon in 2009, Captain Chelsea Sully Sullenberger lifted the Airbus A320 carrying 150 passengers and five crew members out of LaGuardia Airport in New York City. At 3:27, 2 minutes after takeoff, the plane struck the flock of birds, which disabled both engines and caused a fire in at least one. The plane was dead in the air. Without sufficient altitude and with no power to climb much higher, Captain Sully promptly determined that returning to the airport was not an option. And only one alternative existed, a water landing on the Hudson River. As Captain Sully lined the plane up with the water, he focused on keeping it level. Too far left or right, and the wings could hit the water first, causing the plane to tear apart. If the plane tilted down too much, it could cartwheel head over heels, killing everyone on board. If it tilted back too much, the plane's tail would catch the water, causing the Airbus to slam down on the surface with the force of a bomb. Minor adjustments were made, both by the onboard electronics and by the captain himself. A little bump left, a little bump right. At 3:29, Captain Sully radioed the three most terrifying words any airline passenger could hear. brace for impact. The plane collided with the water of the Hudson River at 3:31 p.m. in full view of the lawyers, stockbrokers, and other professionals in the skyscrapers along the Manhattan skyline. Because of the precise leveling of the plane and Captain Sully's experience, the plane did not tear apart, nor did it flip. It landed perfectly on the water, and Captain Sully, along with the four other members of the crew, assisted all 150 passengers to safety. Captain Sully was an American hero. In an interview with the news anchor Katie Couric after the event, Sullenberger said, "One way of looking at this might be that for 42 years, I've been making small, regular deposits in the bank of experience, education, and training. And on January 15th, the balance was sufficient so I could make a very large withdrawal." As I prepared to write this chapter on negotiation, my thoughts immediately went to the concept of an emergency water landing and the miracle on the Hudson. Negotiation is the art of staying steady in a turbulent situation. It's about making minor adjustments to the left or to the right, backwards and forwards. It's about keeping calm when all hope seemed lost. It's about successfully handling the unforeseen circumstances that hit you right in the face. Although you may never safely crash land an airliner onto the Hudson River, I believe that you have, that every person has, the skills to become a great negotiator. All you need are small, regular deposits into the bank of experience, education, and training. In this chapter, I'm going to give you that. The negotiation process. In the previous chapter, I talked about the process of offering on a piece of real estate. What happens next, however, is somewhat out of your control. You wait for a response. A seller could respond to your offer in three different ways. Number one, they could accept it. Or two, they could reject it or ignore it. Or three, they might make a counter offer. If they accept it, great. If they reject it, well, that's okay. There's always another deal. Or you could reoffer again when the seller wises up. However, when a seller submits a counter offer, that is when the real fun begins. A counter offer, often just called a counter, is a response to another earlier offer. In other words, if you offered $100,000 on a property and the seller says, "No, I want $110,000, well, that response from the seller is the counter offer. In most of the deals I've offered on, the original offer has not been accepted. The same will likely be true for you, and that is not a bad thing. I argue that if your initial offer is accepted, you probably offered too much. Of course, if you are in a highly competitive market, this might not be the case, but generally, I consider a counteroffer a good thing. It means the seller wants to sell to me and is willing to find common ground where both parties can get what they want. The negotiation process is where the two sides try to make that happen. Remember, both parties really want the exact same thing, a sale. Many people use the word negotiation and envision one party winning and the other losing. However, in a good negotiation, both parties walk away feeling like they achieved pretty much, if not exactly, what they wanted. When there is no negotiation, that's when one of the parties tends to feel they got shafted. So remember, a little back and forth is a good thing. You gotta keep it level. In this chapter, I will explain how to do that successfully. Keep in mind, I'm not referring to negotiating just on price. In fact, there are multiple parts of the contract that can be negotiated. For example, you can negotiate for any of the following. Price, how much are you actually going to pay for the property? Closing date, when will you close? Next week? Next month? Closing location, where is the closing going to take place? Your title company? Theirs? An attorney's office? Contingencies, what contingencies could be removed from the purchase and sale agreement? Financing, will the seller perhaps agree to carry a second mortgage on the property? Closing costs, who will pay for what during the closing process? Home warranty, a home warranty is sometimes included in the sale of a home and covers certain repair items after the sale happens. This can help smooth out concerns on the part of the buyer. Will your deal include one? If so, who's going to pay for it? Repairs, what do you need the seller to fix before you purchase the property? Will you hold them to it? Will you buy the property as is? Credits. What about getting credits at closing towards certain repairs that are needed? If a new roof is needed and the seller doesn't want to put one on at closing, could you negotiate the cost of a new roof given to you at closing? Possession date. When will you actually take possession of the property? While it is most common to transfer possession immediately after the title has been transferred, this is negotiable. Maybe the seller needs a few more weeks. Maybe you want to get in early. It's all negotiable. Items left in the property. What is the seller required to leave with the property? Appliances? Tools? Furniture? Really, it's all negotiable. Again, these are all elements that you can negotiate, either offering or asking for a concession. A concession is when the other party gives up something in the negotiation. Perhaps the seller is firm on the price, but you can get more repairs done on the property before closing. Or perhaps they don't want to do anything with the condition or the price, but the seller is willing to carry a contract on the property, seller financing, for a short period while you fix it up. The possibilities are nearly endless as to what your negotiation can produce. So look at negotiation as a huge opportunity for you to creatively achieve your goals. When you're offering on a property through the MLS, the negotiation will typically take place through the agent. You'll likely never sit down across from the seller and engage in some television-worthy negotiation. Instead, the negotiation will take place through a back-and-forth exchange of documents signed by you, given to your agent, sent to their agent, and finally given to the seller. The seller will then either accept, reject, or reply with a counteroffer. Your job at that point will be to either accept the counter, reject it, or reply with your own another counter. When offering on a property outside the MLS through a private seller, your negotiations will be likely much more direct. In fact, you might negotiate every point on the hood of your car or sitting at the seller's kitchen table. Yesterday, I negotiated a deal while sitting inside the seller's pickup truck just outside the house I was buying. The back and forth will likely be much less formal, though I still recommend putting as much of the negotiation on paper as possible, even if that means just pulling out a sheet of blank paper and writing down the terms. When to negotiate. There are three primary times that you might consider negotiating the terms of an offer. Number one, at the beginning. The most intense negotiations you'll likely encounter when buying a property will happen at the beginning, immediately after you submit an offer. This is when the big items on the agenda are hashed out and your ideal offer is presented to the seller. You submit an offer, they counteroffer, and you might counteroffer after that, so on and so forth, until either an agreement is reached or you go your separate ways. Number two, after the inspection. If the inspection reveals some defect in the property that you were not expecting, you can negotiate again at this point. If you included an inspection contingency in your offer and you are within your inspection time frame, you can back out of the deal and we'll get your earnest money back. Some investors choose to negotiate very lightly at the beginning and instead push their weight around after the inspection. Personally, I don't really recommend this tactic unless you absolutely have to. This is not a great time to negotiate because at this point, you have likely spent a good deal of money on the inspection, possible appraisals, and other aspects of the deal. However, if you do find something you didn't expect during the inspection, don't be afraid to renegotiate the deal. Just don't be a jerk about it. Number three, anytime. In reality, negotiations can and will happen at every step of the process. Until the property's title is officially transferred from seller to buyer at closing, the real estate deal always feels as though it's balanced and on the edge of a cliff, and the slightest breeze could push it over. Negotiation is about both parties keeping the deal from falling, so slight negotiation is needed throughout the process to make sure it closes. 13 tips for successful negotiation. Although the following tips may not work in every case, the more negotiation strategies you know, the better you'll be able to negotiate any deal. You'll likely find that you already use a number of these strategies in your own daily life, whether negotiating with your kids, your spouse, or your coworkers. Number one, be prepared to walk away. Perhaps the most important negotiation strategy of all is being 100% prepared to walk away from a deal if you don't get what you want. When you don't need something as much as the other person, your position is strengthened. This is much more difficult than it might seem, though, especially for new investors. You work so hard to find a deal and finally locate something that might work, so now you are likely emotionally attached to the deal. You really want the deal to go through, and I get it. But if you are desperate, you've already lost that negotiation. Also, make sure the other party knows that you are prepared to walk from the deal if you don't get what you need. Number two, know your role. Before going into a negotiation and throughout the negotiation process, know your role and where you stand. What is the prize? If you walk into a negotiation like John Wayne and start demanding a ton of concessions, but the seller has five backup offers on their property because it's a seller's market, you just make a fool of yourself and they'll slam the door on your offer and turn to one of the other buyers. So have an accurate perspective on where you stand, in the negotiation. Number three, always get the last concession. The negotiation process contains a lot of back and forth, asking for and offering concessions. For example, the seller might ask you to pay $100,000 and you can accept, but only if they pay your closing costs. Maybe they'll come back and say, I can't pay all of them, but I can pay some. So you can reply with, sure, as long as you throw in a home warranty. As Jay Scott, author of the book on flipping houses, once wrote, if the other party realizes that every time he asks for something, he will need to give something, he will naturally shy away from asking for more than what he needs in fear that he'll be asked to give up something important in return for additional non-essential demands on his part. Number four, find true motivation. What does the other party really need from the negotiation? Often, the true motivation is not what you think it is. Maybe they need to close quickly, so price is less important. Maybe they don't want to lose their recurring income from their rental properties, so they might be open to seller financing. Use the negotiation time to discover what their true motivation is and try to give them what they need while you get everything else you want. Number five, use a red herring. This negotiation strategy is named after a technique used to train dogs for fox hunting competitions by distracting the animal with a strong scent of a dead fish. The red herring tactic is meant to drive the negotiation to focus on something inconsequential, distracting the seller from what you really want. For example, you might really want the best price, but when you offer that low price, you also offer and focus on something you know the seller isn't going to give up, like agreeing to leave their fine dining china in the home. They may insist that the china is non-negotiable, perhaps even be a little offended you ask, but it'll make the low price offer appear a little better. This guy is crazy, they'll say. There's no way we're giving you grandma's fine china. We'll take the price, but we're keeping our china. And you'll smile and accept. Number six, institute a penalty when they ask for concessions. The negotiation process can be awkward and uncomfortable for all parties, but everyone wants the same thing. You can help your negotiation by making it a little more uncomfortable by instituting a penalty whenever the other party asks for a concession. A penalty could be as simple as not responding for several days or requiring your lawyer to look over the issue. This will train the other party to stop asking for concessions because they'll quickly realize it hurts them every time they do. Number seven, stick to your numbers. Real estate is largely a game of mathematics and numbers. So while negotiating, stick to your numbers and don't let emotion take over. Appealing to the math is a great strategy when negotiating because it's really hard to argue with. Mr. Seller, you'll say, at $100,000, my expenses with taxes, insurance, vacancy, maintenance, and management will be almost $900 a month, and I can only rent the property out for $1,000, which would only give me a 5% return on investment. That just doesn't work for me, but at $90,000, it would push my return up to 9%, which does work for me. I mean, it's hard to argue with that. Number eight, don't get offended. Keep the negotiation light and don't get offended. Remember, it's all a game of back and forth. I've seen friends carry on negotiations that look a lot like this. My friend, I can pay $100,000. The seller, no, $100,000 is way too low. I need at least $120,000. My friend, screw you, you're crazy. End of negotiation. Don't be like my friend. Keep it light so neither side gets offended. Your goal is to keep working the negotiation until both sides get what they want. So unbunch your panties and sit down at the negotiation table until you get what you came for. Number nine. Negotiate with data. When possible, use data to negotiate your point. One of the best ways to do this when buying a piece of property is by having comparable sales, comps, with you when negotiating. The seller may want $150,000 for their property, but if you can show them that other similar properties have sold recently for only between $120,000 and $130,000, you'll take them out of their fantasy land and ground them in cold hard facts. It's hard to argue with data. Number 10, don't be insulting. Don't insult the other party or their property. Don't tell them they're crazy, that their property is a pile of junk, or that they're terrible negotiators. You'll need to keep the other party liking you while negotiating. Number 11, let the other party feel good. At the end of a negotiation, both parties should feel as though they won and the terms are fair. You never want to leave a negotiation with the other party feeling completely ripped off. Therefore, be sure to give something as well when negotiating and don't dominate every point. Let the seller believe that they are a good negotiator and got some great concessions out of you. Let them see you bleed a little bit. For example, If your maximum allowable offer on a deal is $67,000, make $62,000 your known big offer and let them push you a bit higher if needed. They'll feel good that they pushed you higher than you wanted, but you'll still get exactly what you wanted. They just didn't know that. Number 12, demonstrate why you are a great buyer. During the negotiation for a property, feel free to remind the other party often why you are a great buyer. If you are paying cash, drop that fact numerous times in the conversation. Let them know how consistent you are with your purchases, how strong your credit is, how pretty you can make the house look when it's all fixed up. You want the other party to want to sell to you, so remind them often that you are the best. When talking with motivated sellers, I like to tell brief stories about other properties I purchased and rehabbed, sharing how I closed so quickly and was able to help the seller out. I find ways to slip into the conversation the benefits of selling to me without making it obvious that I'm selling myself. This helps encourage the seller to keep negotiating and ultimately sell the property to me. Number 13, ask for their lowest price and then go lower. When negotiating in person with a motivated seller, one tactic that works almost every time is simple. Ask the seller what their lowest price is. They'll usually tell you a number, but this is never their real lowest price. This is their starting price. Then ask them a follow-up question like, okay, but what if I could pay all cash and close next week? They will almost always go a little lower. If you wanted to push it one more time, you could say something like, so if I were to offer you an amount even lower than their new lowest price and get you the cash you needed in the next 10 days, would that be unreasonable? Nobody likes to appear unreasonable, and there's a good chance they'll respond with, yeah, I could do that. In just a minute or less, you were able to talk them down twice from their lowest price, potentially saving you thousands or even tens of thousands of dollars. Calculate that on a per hour basis, and it'll be the easiest money you ever made. Conclusion. Like crash landing a plane on an icy river, your goal with your negotiation is to keep it level and safely accomplish your goals. Negotiation is about the give and take, the minor adjustments to the left and to the right that will help you bring your next deal to a happy landing. However, unlike plane crashes, negotiation is not a rare occurrence. It takes place at every part of the real estate transaction in every part of the world. It can be uncomfortable, awkward, and a little scary. It requires patience, practice, and guts. However, if you don't negotiate, finding a great deal and reaching your real estate goals will be incredibly hard. So overcome those fears, learn to master the art of negotiation, stick to your numbers, and go build yourself an incredible future. Chapter 13, Financing Your Rental Property. Steve Jobs once said, creativity is just connecting things. When you ask creative people how they did something, they feel a little guilty because they didn't really do it. They just saw something. It seemed obvious to them after a while. That is because they were able to connect experiences they've had and synthesize new things. When I purchased my first home, my real estate agent gave me a $100 gift card to the local hardware store. I knew nothing about rehabbing properties, but I was ecstatic. For the first time in my life, I was going to buy tools, my very own tools. My first purchase consisted of the basics, a hammer, screwdrivers, a drill, and a few miscellaneous objects I thought I might need to successfully tackle the rehab of my home. I went back to my newly purchased property and got to work, but I quickly ran into problems when my hammer and drill proved ineffective for most of what needed to be done. I found myself back at the hardware store, buying more tools so I could accomplish more tasks around the house. Over the past decade, I've acquired an entire garage of tools that allow me to handle anything from flooring, plumbing, to roofing, to foundation. Understanding financing is a lot like collecting tools in a toolbox. The more tools you have, the more and bigger projects you'll be able to tackle, and the more successful you'll be. Since I began investing in real estate nearly a decade ago, I purchased real estate in almost every way possible. If you are new to real estate, you might be asking yourself, how many ways are there, really? The answer? A lot. My goal in this chapter is to educate you on the most popular ways of financing rental properties, whether you have $100,000 in the bank or just a few bucks. I'll cover traditional methods as well as the more creative options in hopes of giving you all the tools you need to tackle whatever projects are put in front of you. Let's start with perhaps the oldest form of financing, cash. All cash. Many investors choose to pay all cash for an investment property. Back in 2012, Bigger Pockets and Memphis Invest conducted a nationwide survey of American citizens and discovered a number of interesting facts, including that 24% of U.S. real estate investors were using 100% cash to finance their investments. To be clear, even when investors use terms like all cash, the truth is no cash is actually traded. In most cases, the buyer brings a check, usually certified funds like a bank cashier's check, to the title company, and the title company writes a check to the seller. Other times, the money is sent via a wire transfer from the bank. This is the easiest form of financing because there are typically no complications, but for most investors, and probably the vast majority of new investors, all cash is simply not an option. However, I want to talk about it for a moment longer anyway. There exists a debate in the investment world about using cash for a property versus getting a loan. In one camp, you have the no-debt people who say a person should only invest in rental properties if they can pay all cash for the deal. The leverage camp responds with the math showing that a person using leverage can obtain a much better return on investment by using a loan. The no-debt camp fires back, but 100% of foreclosures happen to people with debt, and the debate rages. So who is right? If you had $100,000, would it be better to buy one house for $100,000 or five houses with a $20,000 down payment on each? Once again, I don't believe there is a right answer, but rather a right answer for you. In other words, what works for me might not work for you. Your decision to use debt will depend heavily on your personal finances, your goals, your age, and other key factors. Using all cash is safer in some regards, of course. If you owned a piece of property worth $100,000 without a mortgage, you could easily sell the property if you needed to. If the property was tough to rent out, you could afford making the tax and insurance payment to keep the property floating until a renter began to pay. For simplicity, let's say that the house was rented for $1,200 per month, taxes and insurance were $200 per month, and all other expenses over time averaged $400 per month. Things like repairs, vacancy, CapEx, maintenance, etc. This means your total expenses on the property, not including the mortgage, would be about $600 per month. And your cash flow would be around $600 per month or $7,200 per year. While this isn't a bad amount of cash flow, it represents just a 7.2% cash-on-cash return. On the other hand, let's say you bought a property, the same one, but used a 20% down payment loan, meaning you took out an $80,000 mortgage. $80,000 at 4.5% interest for 30 years is about $400 a month. So add that $400 to the $600 in expenses we already assumed, and now you're at $1,000 per month in total expenses with the mortgage in place, leaving you with $200 per month in cash flow, or just $2,400 a year, far less, of course, than the $7,200 per year we saw with the all-cash purchase. However, $2,400 in cash flow on a $20,000 investment represents a 12% cash-on-cash return on investment, a pretty drastic difference. Now, maybe the difference between 7.2% and 12% doesn't seem that drastic, but check out this chart in Figure 13 at biggerpockets.com/rentalbookfigures that shows what the $100,000 investment over 30 years looks like at 7.2% and 12%. For those listening to the audiobook, the figure shows the two lines begin fairly close together, year one, year two, year three. You can hardly distinguish it. But as it goes, by year 30, the low interest, the 7.2, that $100,000 has turned into roughly $750,000. The high interest, though, the 12% after 30 years, has turned into $3 million. Clearly, leverage can increase the ROI with the property. However, is the increase worth the increased risk you are also taking? Well, that is a question for you to decide. However, let me mention a few more possible concerns with paying all cash for a property. In Chapter 1, I talked about the four wealth generators of rental properties, and those were appreciation, cash flow, tax savings, and the loan paydown. We've already seen that paying all cash can help you get a higher cash flow dollar amount, but potentially a lower cash-on-cash return. But let's see how that affects the other three wealth generators. Appreciation. The property will appreciate the same amount whether you have a loan or not. However, again, what changes is the return on investment. If you paid $100,000 for the property with all cash, and in 1 year the property value climbs to $110,000, you have effectively increased your wealth by 10% and made $10,000 in equity. If you used that 20% down payment and only spent $20,000 on the property, and the value then climbed to $110,000, you'd have made $10,000 in equity. However, you just made $10,000 in equity but only invested $20,000, which means you've increased your entire wealth by 50%. Of course, the leverage game works both ways. If the property were to decrease in value, you could be looking at a catastrophic loss in value. However, if you are following the rest of the guidelines in this book and are buying great rental property deals, and if the appreciation is only the icing on the cake, you could continue holding until the value rose again. Tax savings. Although you will still get the depreciation benefits if you own a property free and clear, which we'll talk about later in the book, you will no longer be able to deduct the mortgage interest payment from your taxes. So you will likely end up paying the IRS each year on the money you make from your rental property. In the example of the $100,000 house, with the all-cash offer, the owner was clearing around $7,200 per year, but can only deduct approximately $3,000 from depreciation, leaving them with a tax bill at the end of the year on that profit. However, when using leverage, the cash flow comes to only $2,400 per year after all expenses. At this point, the $3,000 deduction for depreciation would show a paper loss on the property, and no taxes would likely be due. Again, keep in mind that this is a very simplistic discussion on depreciation, and of course you should consult with a CPA for more information. We'll also talk a lot more about taxes later in the book. Finally, loan paydown. Of course, if you have no loan on a property, you have no loan paydown. You have essentially killed completely one of the four wealth generators. In the example of the $100,000 property, the tenant is paying off that $80,000 mortgage little by little, which increases your total return. Although you started with a mortgage of $80,000, after 10 years, you might only owe $65,000 on the property, increasing your net worth by $15,000 because your tenant paid the mortgage every month. After 30 years, or whatever loan length you used, the property would be 100% paid off, and you never, hopefully, had to make that payment yourself. Of course, you are still physically making the payment, but it is your tenant's rent that is covering that payment. Liability with cash offers. Finally, I want to talk about one more reason you may or may not want to use cash. Liability. When investing in real estate, there's a very good chance that someday somebody is going to try to sue you. When you own a property free and clear, this is typically evident on the public record because there is no bank lien on the property. Therefore, you are essentially holding up a sign that says, "I have lots of money that you can try and take." If a disgruntled tenant approaches a lawyer to try to sue you, which scenario do you think will make the lawyer more excited to go after you? You have $100,000 in equity on a property, or $20,000 of equity on a property? If the latter, the lawyer would understand that even if he did win the lawsuit, the most they could do is force a sale of a property, probably at a discount. After all the closing costs, there'd be little or no meat left on the bone. Therefore, lawyers, especially those paid on the outcome of a lawsuit, as most lawyers of this type are reluctant to pursue rental owners who have a lot of leverage. It may seem to you that I'm trying to talk you out of using leverage, but honestly, that is not my goal. There are more important things in life than maximizing your ROI. Security, flexibility, and the, quote, happy wife, happy life, or happy husband, philosophy may matter to you more than maximizing your return. Maybe that 7.2% cash-on-cash return, for example, combined with the possible appreciation on the deal, would be more than enough for you. Well, great. My goal in this section was to simply share with you the benefits and the risks of both options. Higher risk may have higher reward, but if you follow that logic to its conclusion, you'll end up spending the next 40 years of your life pulling the handle on the slot machine waiting for the big reward. That said, here are a couple quick tips if you do plan to use all cash on your investment properties. Number one, pretend that you aren't. Using all cash makes people lazy. When buyers can simply write a check for the property, it's natural not to have the same motivation to find an incredible deal. Therefore, when buying a property for all cash, pretend you are not doing so. Run the numbers as though you had to obtain 100% financing for the property. Would it still cash flow? If not, you may want to think twice about buying it. Analyze your cash on cash return and make sure you aren't using your all cash purchase to justify a bad deal. Number two, use entities wisely. If you are going to own properties free and clear, at least try to hide the fact. Talk with your CPA and lawyer to discover the best way to hide your ownership from the public record. Number three, consider financing later. Using all cash when making an offer can help you get better deals because sellers love cash offers. However, just because you bought a property with all cash doesn't mean you have to keep it that way. You can place financing on the property after the purchase, usually 6 to 12 months later, depending on the bank, and start taking advantage of all the benefits of using leverage. It can be the best of both worlds, really. And if you are concerned about the risks, also understand that financing doesn't need to be 80%. Maybe you want to obtain a 50% loan or a 30% loan or a 70% loan. The options are plentiful. Using all cash is just one option for finance in real estate. And for most people, possibility doesn't even exist. So let's talk about some of the other strategies for financing real estate, beginning with a conventional loan. Conventional loans. Conventional loans are the standard loans you might obtain from a local bank, credit union, or mortgage lender. They are very similar to the kind of mortgage you would obtain when buying a home to live in. The bank or lender who lent the money on your own home, if you have obtained a mortgage in the past, can probably lend on your rental properties too. However, although loans on primary residences tend to have some fabulous low down payment options, with a conventional rental property loan, you will need to come up with a sizable down payment, typically 20 to 30%, depending on the lender. In addition, a conventional loan will require you to meet a certain debt to income requirement, income level, and other metrics, which I'll cover in a lot more depth in the next chapter. How conventional loans work. When a lender creates a mortgage for you, it's actually fairly likely that they will sell the loan. In fact, that is the primary job of most lenders. Issue a bunch of mortgages, package them together with a big bow, and sell the loan package so the lender gets their money back. The most likely buyer of these loan packages are the two government-sponsored enterprises, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The nicknames given to the Federal National Mortgage Association, FNMA or Fannie Mae, and the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, FHLMC or Freddie Mac. The purpose of these huge pseudo-government organizations is to buy up mortgages from lenders so the lenders can get their money back and can reloan it again. As such, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, like any other mortgage buyer, wants to know exactly what they are getting, so they have very strict requirements on what they will and will not buy. They'll define loan amount ranges, borrower credit score minimums, loan-to-value minimums, and other requirements. Again, I'll cover each of these more specifically in the next chapter, but my point here is to let you know, if you plan to go conventional, you must be a round peg that will fit in the round hole. No square pegs allowed. The conventional lending process in 7 steps. Getting a conventional loan is not a complicated process, but there are a lot of moving parts. So allow me to give you a quick summary of the entire process so you'll best know what to expect when getting your loan. Step 1. Shop. When shopping for a conventional loan, I recommend beginning your loan search before you get the property under contract. After all, the bank needs to approve both you and the deal before lending. So you might as well get the first half of the equation out of the way to make sure you aren't wasting anyone's time. It would be best to know before shopping for a deal whether or not your credit score is high enough to secure the deal. Start with a bank that you already have your primary checking account with. Schedule an appointment with the loan officer and actually sit down with them. Ask them what kind of loan program they have for rental property loans. Ask them the rental property loan amounts they typically lend on, and the current interest rates, the terms, and any other information. Have the same conversation with 3 or 4 other lenders in your area, and be sure to mix it up between banks, credit unions, and mortgage companies. Once you have the basics from each company, pick one and get pre-qualified. Step 2, pre-approval. Getting pre-qualified means getting a conditional yes from the bank before you even find a deal by bringing in all your financial paperwork. In other words, the bank approves you before they even see what property you hope to buy. Now, of course, the deal will need to make sense to them, but getting yourself and your financials approved is the most difficult part. Of course, it is possible to skip the pre-approval and just bring a deal and your paperwork in, but when you're hunting for a killer real estate deal, the pre-approval can help a lot. Step 3. Submit the property information. Once you find your deal, it is time to get the second half of your approval equation started, the approval of the property. The lender will require you to submit, or have your real estate agent submit, information about the property, most likely the purchase and sale agreement. The lender may also want to see additional documents from you if it's been a while since you got pre-approved, such as updated pay stubs or bank account information. Step 4. The loan goes to underwriting. When all the information has been gathered, It is sent to the lender's underwriter, who will give the final yes or no on the loan. It is likely that during this time, the underwriter will make you jump through numerous hoops before giving you the loan. In the next chapter, I'll go into a lot more detail on this process and how to ensure that you do get a yes. Step 5. Lender issues an appraisal. The lender will likely hire a residential real estate appraiser to give them a valuation on the property. The lender's goal, of course, is to be secure in their investments, so they want to make sure they are not loaning more on the property than they should, and also that the property is in good enough condition for them to loan on. A typical single-family house appraisal will cost approximately $400, while a small multifamily appraisal might cost up to $1,000. If you are buying a commercial property, expect to be in for at least $4,000. This appraisal cost is not generally fronted by the lender, but you'll be required to pay this before the appraiser goes out. This, of course, is to protect the lender from spending money on an appraiser and then having the loan not go through. Step 6. The loan goes back to underwriting. After the appraisal is complete, the underwriter once again reviews all the documents for the property, including the information just obtained in the appraisal, and decides whether or not they want to take the risk of lending to you. They may, once again, ask for you to jump through certain hoops. For example, I once had an appraiser require that the gutter downspouts on a property have splash blocks installed before they would issue a yes on the loan. They also, once again, may want to see more pay stubs or other financials from you. Just get them what they need and do it as quickly as possible. The biggest delay in the underwriting process is usually the borrower needing to get paperwork to the lender, so don't be a clog in your own pipe. Ultimately, underwriting will either approve or deny the loan. Step 7. The loan closes. If the loan is approved, the bank will let you or your real estate agent know. The title company or attorney will also be informed, and closing will take place soon after. At the closing table, typically at your title company or your attorney's office, you will bring a check for the down payment and your lender will wire over the funds for the purchase. The title company or attorney will take care of the paperwork and you'll be the owner of a new property. The pros and cons of conventional lending. Although conventional lending is perhaps the most common type of real estate loan, it may or may not be the best option for you. There are both advantages and disadvantages to be aware of before obtaining a loan, and the more aware you are, the better loan decision can make. Pros: low interest rates. There's no denying it, conventional loans likely have the best rates you'll find for long-term real estate financing. With investment loans, usually 0.5 to 1 point higher than the owner-occupied loans, you can borrow money at incredibly low rates. As of this writing, you can still get investment loans at less than 5% interest. This will help keep your mortgage payment low and thereby maximize your cash flow. Long term. When you borrow from a conventional lender, your loan will likely be able to extend for a long term, maybe even up to 30 years if you're buying a residential property. This can help keep your payments low, though it will also extend the amount of time that you'll have debt on the house. Professional. A conventional lender is in the business of lending, so the entire process is much more defined and professional than a relationship-based loan would be. This isn't the lender's first rodeo. Cons: a max number of loans. Conventional loans may have great terms and rates, but real estate investors are capped on the number of conventional loans they can have. The current limit has been raised to 10 loans, though many investors are not even able to get to that limit because of the rise in their debt-to-income ratio, the DTI. In other words, for every loan you obtain, debt, the percentage of your debt to your W-2 income rises until you are pushed out of the acceptable range defined by the conventional lender. I'll talk more about DTI, debt to income, a lot more in the next chapter. A slow process. Conventional loans are not fast to obtain. Because of the legal scrutiny your loan must go through and the mounds of paperwork you must provide, the process of obtaining a loan can be arduous, usually taking 30 days or much longer. Property condition. Conventional lenders only want to lend on properties that are in good shape. This can rule out a lot of the best properties for investors because we tend to focus on properties that are in terrible condition so we can improve their quality and value. If the property is missing any of the basic necessities for home living, for example, it has bad flooring, poor paint job, a leaky roof, the bank will likely not fund the deal until the issues are fixed. Not very entity friendly. Conventional lenders are also not very fond of loaning on properties owned by an entity, like an LLC or a corporation, especially for residential properties. In other words, if you want to keep your name off the public record and add some asset protection by purchasing the property with your LLC, a conventional lender will likely not let you do it, at least for residential. You could, as many investors do, buy the property in your personal name and then transfer it to your LLC, but you put yourself at risk of having the due on sale clause called by the bank. The due on sale clause is a part of nearly every mortgage paperwork that says, basically, if you sell or transfer the property, we have the right to call your loan due now or foreclose on you. This has been happening more and more lately in the real estate space, so I can't always suggest it's a good idea. Be sure to talk to your lawyer and CPA who can help you sort these types of issues out. But the point is this, conventional lenders don't like entities. So should you use a conventional loan? Personally, I love getting conventional loans if I can get them. However, those days have long since passed for me because I've hit the limit on the number of conventional loans I can obtain. If you are still able to do so, I would definitely strongly encourage you to use a conventional loan for your next property. Very few financing strategies can live up to the low cost and stability of a conventional loan. Let's now talk about another loan that operates very similarly to the conventional loan, but avoids some of the disadvantages conventional loans have. Portfolio lenders. In the previous section, I discussed how most financial lenders sell their loans in packages to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. As a result, those conventional lenders must abide by the strict rules handed down from these government-sponsored enterprises. However, not all banks operate the same way. Some banks choose to instead hold on to their loans and keep the money in the community. These are known as portfolio lenders, and they can be a powerful ally for a growing real estate investor. Because these portfolio lenders keep some of their loans on their own books, in other words, in a portfolio of loans that they own, they don't have to fit in the same government-prescribed box. Instead, because they are lending their own money, they can be a lot more creative. The maximum rule of 4 or 10 properties, not with a portfolio lender. The debt-to-income problem, easily explained to a portfolio lender. So can you see how powerful these lenders can be? Now keep in mind, I'm not suggesting that a portfolio lender is easier to qualify for. Portfolio lenders still have a minimum qualification that must be met, and your loan will still need to be approved by the portfolio lender's board of underwriters. Don't think that a 520 credit score will work, and don't assume you'll be able to get zero down loans. In this category, the lender might even be more strict, but the rules are much more flexible and you'll likely be dealing with a person, not a faceless corporation. How to find a portfolio lender. Before the real estate crash of 2007 and 2008, there were many more portfolio lenders operating in the US. Today, you'll have to search a little harder. None of the big banks, the national ones with television commercials, will do portfolio lending. Instead, you'll want to focus your search on small, local community banks. Look for banks that have a maximum of 20 different branches. Credit unions might also be a good source of portfolio lending. Of course, portfolio lenders will not be labeled as such. No brochure in their lobby will use the word portfolio lender, and no category in the yellow pages will list them for you. Instead, you'll simply need to call them up and find out. In episode 6 of the Bigger Pockets podcast, investor Arthur Garcia talks about how he did just this. He picked up the phone book, called every lender listed, and simply asked, "Do you do any portfolio lending?" Eventually, he found a great portfolio lender in his area, ironically based out of a Walmart. If you follow the strategy, just be sure to do the following. 1, ask to speak with the loan officer because the teller will likely have no idea how to help. 2, even the loan officer might not be familiar with the term portfolio lender, so you may need to explain exactly what you mean and what you're seeking. Portfolio lenders are often both conventional and portfolio, and they can put you in whatever loan fits your needs best. Also, keep in mind that portfolio loans may be slightly higher in rate and shorter in term, or they may involve a balloon payment. A balloon payment is a due date on the loan that is shorter than the amortized term. For example, you may have a 30-year fixed rate loan, but if it has a 10-year balloon, you must pay the entire balance of the loan off at year 10, most likely through a refinance. Portfolio lenders have been incredibly helpful in my own investing career. And if you can build a solid relationship with a portfolio lender, I think you'll have the same experience. So get out there this week and start building that relationship. Now, let's talk about a form of lending that doesn't involve a bank or a credit union, private lenders. Private lenders. What is private lending? Private lending is exactly what it sounds like, borrowing money from private individuals rather than institutional lenders. Private lending is used all over the world by real estate investors and is perhaps the oldest of all forms of lending. Generally speaking, when investors use the term private lending, they are referring to lending based heavily on relationships. Although the first form of private lending is typically through family or friends, it doesn't have to be. You could borrow money from pretty much any person, anywhere. And as long as that entity is not a bank or mortgage company or something similar, that transaction could be called private lending. To illustrate how private lending works, let me tell you the story about a deal I'm putting together right now. The Cedar House is located about 1.5 miles from my personal house in a great location. This 1960s Styles house needs some basic updating, including fresh paint and carpet, but it also needs new siding, new windows, and a new garage door. Now, if I wanted to, I could go to a local bank and drop 20 to 25% down on a down payment for the property and come up with the repair money out of pocket after closing. That is, of course, if the bank would lend on the house at all. After all, as I explained earlier, banks don't like to lend on properties that need work. Instead, I'm turning to private lending. Through the reputation I built for myself on BiggerPockets, I've received notices from several individuals over the past several years who are interested in talking more about private lending. These are not bankers, but just people looking for a good investment on their money. After several conversations with different individuals, I felt a strong connection with one in particular, and we're now in the process of closing on the deal. They'll lend the purchase price and maybe even the repair money, and I'll get the house for little out-of-pocket money. Then, each month, rather than paying a bank the mortgage payment, I'll pay this individual the mortgage payment. In a year or so, after a period of seasoning, as they call it, I'll go to a bank and get a traditional 30-year mortgage on the property. Then, I'll pay off the private lender, drop my interest rate, and increase my cash flow. Typically, a private money lender is looking for a fairly short-term loan, but this is not always the case. Some investors are in this lending game for the long haul. If you find these lenders, hang on tight and treat them right. They can be pure gold to you. Now, let's address a fundamental question involving private lenders. Why would someone lend their money to you through a private loan rather than placing it in the stock market or funding their own real estate deals? Well, here's a few reasons. Number one, higher return. Private lenders lend money because they want a good ROI. Perhaps they believe they can get a higher return by investing with you than by putting the money in the stock market or somewhere else. Although private lending rates are not standard and are essentially whatever is negotiated, these rates are usually higher than a borrower would get from the bank or a mortgage company. The most common private money rates I see fall between 6 and 12%, depending on the relationship. Number two, security. Let's just say a person places their cash in the stock market, investing in ABC Soda Company, and the very next week, the CEO of ABC Soda is photographed snorting drugs in a brothel, which drives the company's stock price down 80%. There is little the investor can do but pull the money out and take the loss. However, if you pull the same stunt and end up not paying your lender, the lender has a lot more security, the property. In other words, on a typical private lending deal, the lender will have a lien on the property, so if you don't live up to your end of the deal, they can take the house, sell it, and get their money back. Passivity. Private lending rates very high on the scale of passivity. In other words, it requires very little physical or mental work over the long run to achieve a solid investment. The lender is not crawling under houses, they're not yelling at contractors, they're not picking up rent checks and filing for eviction. They are walking out to their mailbox, picking up a check, or with the direct deposit these days, they might not even be doing that much work. Of course, if the borrower does not pay, the level of passivity decreases dramatically because the lender will need to take steps to get their money back, likely through foreclosure on the property. However, a lawyer typically handles that. Private versus hard money lending. I feel it's probably a good idea to talk briefly here about the difference between hard money and private money. Both terms are tossed around interchangeably in the real estate industry, and there's a lot of confusion about the difference. Let me try to sort this out a bit. Hard money is a form of private lending, and private lending is a form of hard money lending. There are a lot of similarities and a lot of crossover, but most investors would agree to the following. Hard money lending is the process of borrowing money from a professional private lender, with the bulk of the lending decision based on the hard asset being bought. In other words, hard money lenders are professionals who lend out their own money or other people's money that they invest with for a living. They have a set way of doing things, a predefined interest rate, a predefined set of fees called points, and a very short term, usually less than 1 year. Private lending, on the other hand, is the process of borrowing money from non-professional lenders, so that the bulk of the lending decision is based on the relationship between the borrower and the lender, but enhanced by the hard asset being bought. In other words, private lenders are lending their own money, but don't typically do that for a living. They might be retired or they might work a normal 9-to-5 job. Their rates, fees, and terms are usually lower and much more negotiable. Again, the difference between hard money lending and private lending is not always black and white, and some lenders fall somewhere in the gray middle. In the end, though, what they call themselves doesn't much matter. The question is, how much is it going to cost you, and does the math still work? Where to find private lenders? Private lenders are everywhere. A recent study by the U.S. Department of Labor and Training shows that 22% of American workers have at least $100,000 in their retirement fund. With 154 million workers in America, that means more than 30 million Americans have more than $100,000 in their retirement account, being shaken around by the stock market or collecting low fixed returns from CDs, annuities, savings accounts, or other conservative investments. These individuals are in your grocery line, at your church, part of your local civic club, in your family. Anyone with a good chunk of money tied up in an IRA, savings account, or under a mattress could become a private lender. However, not just any rich person is ideal to work with. You want to find individuals who are easy to work with and understand that there is risk involved. You don't want to borrow grandma's last dollar. But how do you recognize those lenders? It's true, they don't wear a sign around their neck, but instead, you got to let them come to you. So follow the simple 3-step process. Number 1, go to where private lenders are. Number 2, build your brand. And number 3, ask. Of course, this is easier said than done, so let me expound on it. First, you must go to where private lenders might be. This means getting out there and networking. Attend your local real estate club. Hang out on the Bigger Pockets forums. Attend local civic events in your area. And next, talk about what you do. Don't brag, but simply let your passion for real estate shine through. And third, don't be afraid to ask people if they would consider private lending. This is the most crucial part of the entire process, so let's focus on the ask. In my previous book, The Book on Investing in Real Estate with No and Low Money Down, I shared a strategy that I like to use. When talking with people about your business, it's a good idea to say something like, "So if you know anyone who's interested in lending on deals like this and working with me, definitely give them my number." This opens up the conversation so they can say, "You know, I might actually be interested in something like that," or "I know a guy who might well be interested." Either way, the seed has been planted and you didn't come across as begging for money, and you might just find some really valuable clients. Of course, when you are just starting out and you don't have a brand to build yet, this can be challenging. You may need to develop that brand first through partnerships, doing smaller deals with hard money, or just by becoming the most knowledgeable guy or girl in the room. How to get a private lender to say yes. Of course, anyone can ask someone to lend the money. I get asked all the time, and I usually turn them down, and you'll be turned down too, unless you understand what the lender wants. The goal of a private lending relationship is to create a win-win solution for both parties. But to understand what win-win is, you need to have a firm grasp on what a private lender is seeking. To help illustrate this, I will outline 8 different things killing your private money chances, and I'll share how you can overcome these roadblocks so you'll hear a yes every time. Number 1, not having a deal. First, if you are struggling to get financing, the simple answer might be that you just don't have a good enough deal. The solution, of course, is go out there and find an incredible deal. Run it by a few other experienced investors on Bigger Pockets forums and see what they think. Is it really going to be a solid investment? Number 2, not hanging with the right people. Who are you associating with? If you spend all your time hanging around your video game buddies, it's unlikely you're going to meet the kind of people who will eventually fund your deal. Get out there and start networking with folks who are more successful than you. Number 3, not building your personal brand. Here's the cold hard truth. People don't lend money to people they don't trust.